Hello and welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. This is a podcast about understanding people better. You can learn more about it at peoplewhoreadpeople.com, and you can sign up for a premium subscription there that gets you ad-free episodes and lets you learn about and collaborate on upcoming episodes. On this episode, I talked to Russell Hurlburt about inner experience, including mental visualization, aphantasia, and inner monologue and narration. Russ has studied inner experiences for more than 5 decades. To quote from the bio on his professor page at University of Nevada, in the 1970s, he was the first to use beepers in psychological research and was the creator of the thought sampling method. Dr. Hurlburt considers the understanding of inner experience to be a fundamental task of psychology, and has written 6 books and many articles exploring how best to investigate experience, end quote. As you might have noticed, there have been a lot of people lately talking about inner experiences, whether that's aphantasia, which is people saying that their thinking has no visual qualities, or about inner narration or the lack of inner narration. For this podcast, I previously aired an interview I'd done about my own so-called aphantasia, and I thought it'd be interesting to follow that up with a more in-depth one with someone who's researched inner experiences. If you've seen aphantasia and inner narration mentioned recently and wondered what's going on with these things, or wondered how your own internal experiences would or should be categorized, I think you'll find this a very interesting talk. We dig into some of the nuances and ambiguities in these areas, and I'll put up some of the resources and books that we mention during this talk on the entry for this episode on my site at peoplewhoreadpeople.com. If you're listening to the audio version of this talk, that audio comes from a video talk I had with Russ. You can find that video on my People Who Read People YouTube channel. Okay, here's the talk with Russ Hurlburt. Hi, Russ. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
So maybe we could start with how you got interested in researching inner experience. I realize that's probably a big question, but maybe you could summarize your beginning interest in it and what you thought was fairly unexamined in that area.
Well, that is a big question, and it's basically my entire career. So it's or before that, depending on how you define career. I was an engineer before I was a trumpet player, and then I was a trumpet player before I was a psychologist, and the interest in all of those things goes back to probably before I was an engineer, so several lifetimes ago. But I've always thought that other people were the most interesting things on the planet, and I've always thought that people's inner lives were the most interesting part of people. And so the object, I've always been interested in that, and in the course of my previous lifetimes, I tried to figure that stuff out and decided that I didn't know and that psychologists didn't know and seemed like nobody knew. And so I set about trying to figure out, well, how would you try to answer that question? And so 50 years ago, a few months ago, actually 50 years and a few months ago, I figured out that the way to do this was to give somebody a beeper and ask them to report what was going on in their inner experience at the moment of a beep. And 50 years ago, that the world was a different place as it is now, and the way that seemed to answer that question then and now too, for that matter, except for everybody almost except me, would be to have given people a pad of questionnaires to triggered when the beep went off, what is now called EMA or ESM or something like that. I was the first one to do that. I invented the beeper in 1973 and used it in 1974 and onwards, starting out with something that would nowadays be called ESM or EMA or that
ilk. And what's that stand for? That
ESM is experience sampling method, and EMA is ecological momentary assessment. And they're both more or less the same thing. Excuse me, that basically involve giving a random beep or some kind of an external beep to people and asking them to fill out some kind of questionnaire, usually a questionnaire. EMA sometimes uses some biological measurements like heart rate or whatever. There's a lot of different ways that people use that, but when it comes down to inner experience, most people are doing questionnaires, triggered by beeps, which is how I started 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. But by 48 years ago, I had decided that I wasn't learning anything that I thought was very interesting. And so I gave up giving questionnaires and launched into what I now call the descriptive experience sampling method, or DES. But it's a simple method, and designed to answer a simple, more simple question. The simple question is, what's in your inner experience? What's your inner experience like when you're being Zach? I'm not particularly interested in what you're like being Zach when I'm giving you some kind of experiment to run. I'm interested in the Zach as Zach goes to the grocery store and interviews people and drives his car and does whatever it is that Zach does. That's when Zach is interesting. He's not so interesting when he's responding to a probe in some kind of a psychological experiment, because that's as much about the experiment as it is about Zach.
Right, because the observing and the experiment change people and such.
Right. So my goal would be, my goal still is, to get at what Zach is like when he's not being interrogated. And so I give you a beeper. You wear the beeper in your everyday life, doing whatever it is that you generally do. And at some random times, the thing beeps, and your task is to pay attention to what was in your inner experience just before the beep occurred. Mm-hmm. I call that the moment of the beep, but what I really mean is something like the last undisturbed moment just before the beep, which is not really undisturbed, but as best we can to get the last undisturbed moment. Or sometimes I call it a microsecond before the beep. It's not a microsecond, and it's not before. But
you're trying to capture those unmonitored, unself-monitored moments.
That's exactly right. So what I want you to do is to capture your self-monitored moment while it's still in short-term memory, whatever that is, while you still have as direct access to it as you can get. Mm-hmm. And let's talk about that.
Yeah, if you had to recommend one book of yours, is there a favorite one that you recommend for people to understand your thoughts in these areas? Or another resource, if it's not a,
I would say a book of mine. If I had to pick one book, it'd probably be my 2011 book, which is called, I don't remember what it's called, Exploring Inner Experience, I think. Cambridge University Press, 2011, whatever that book is called. I think it's called Moments of Truth. That's the book.
Gotcha.
But there are two other books that people might be interested in. One is a debate basically with a philosopher, Eric Schwitzgebel. That's my 2007 book. That's the one that's called Describing Inner Experience? Schwitzgebel is a skeptic about introspective kinds of things. And so we have a book length debate about that. And then my most recent book is sort of like that, except one step more modern, I guess. It's a debate in a way with a literary scholar about inner experience.
That sounds interesting. Yeah, I wanted to read that the Schwitzgebel one. That looked really interesting because you go through examining, you know, snippets of people, a specific person's descriptions of their inner thought and going back and forth with his skepticism and your thoughts on it. Yeah, that looked really interesting.
That's exactly what that book is about.
But
I guess I should also say I have been creating a website for the last 3 or 4 years that I'll send you the link to it, and you can make that available to your folks. But basically, the interviews that I do. So if you were going to be a subject in my research, you'd wear the beeper. We'd get for a day, and we would get together and talk about the half a dozen beeps that you got on that particular day. Mm. And you wouldn't be very good at it because it's a skill that you have to master, like any other skill. And so we would say, well, you need to do this again. And so tomorrow or next week or whenever it's convenient, we do it again. And then we do it again. And then we do it again. And on the second or third day, you'd start to get pretty good at it. And on the fourth, fifth, or sixth day, you would, typically, you would we would be talking, we would be limiting our discussion pretty much to talking about your inner experience at the moment of these beeps, and we'd have ruled out the stuff that isn't really inner experience, and we'd be ruled out the stuff that isn't before the beep and isn't. And so I have been of recent years, I guess, recording those and putting them entirely on the web with quite carefully drawn transcripts with annotations about what's happening. So if people are really interested in what we're talking about here, they can go to that website and spend 100 hours listening to me ask Jack, the Zacks of the world, what's going on in their inner experience, and read the transcripts and read some discussions about the questions that they might have. So basically I prepare the transcripts carefully, and then I answer questions that I think people might have, or make comments that I think people might have who would be seriously interested in what it takes to find out about Zach's inner experience.
And I would imagine with all the recent interest in aphantasia and mental imagery and people talking about inner monologues, have you seen an uptick in people reaching out to you in the last few years about those kinds of things? Because it really seems like some of that stuff has gone kind of viral in terms of, you know, people writing about it on social media and their experiences and whether they have aphantasia or not, these kinds of things. Have you seen a lot more interest in the last few years?
Yes, I would say the interest has gone up fairly dramatically in the last 7 or 10 years, something.
So what are your, maybe pivoting to the aphantasia area, what would be your summation of that? Because from my perspective, I would classify myself as someone with aphantasia. Like I don't identify with reporting mental imagery and these kinds of things. I actually did a previous podcast where someone interviewed me for their podcast on those things, asking me questions about that. But at the same time, I see a lot of ambiguity there. Like I'm very uncertain about, if I do get a sense that there are differences that exist, because it's kind of hard for me to understand how somebody could report having something very visual. But I also see a lot of ambiguity in the sense that, you know, I've talked to a lot of people that are like, I don't know if, you know, I'm not sure if I would qualify these things as visual or not, or how visual they are. So, and a lot of it seems to come down to, for at least some spectrum of the differences, seems to come down to, you know, the difficulties of reporting inner experiences. But I'm curious to ask you, what do you have, like a high level view of how you see that landscape?
Well, yes, I've got lots of views on that subject. The first one I would say is that the skepticism that you're reporting there is good. I think you ought to be skeptical about that. But the second I would say is that what you should be saying when you're expressing that skepticism is, well, what we need is a good method, and we should spend some time thinking about what the method is. I've spent 50 years thinking about the method, and descriptive experience sampling, DES, what I do, is the best that I can do. That doesn't mean it's the ultimate method. It means it's the best that I've been able to find 50 years of pretty careful looking. And I would say most people don't look very carefully, and so the methods that they use are not very good. And the methods that they use are sort of like what you've described, which is sort of like armchair introspection into trying to just decide what my inner experience is like. And I would say that's a very difficult thing to do. And so that's the first part of my answer to your question. The second part.
And really quick, I'll throw in there one interesting example of like how hard these things are to describe. When I asked one person about this, they initially said, oh yeah, I would describe it as visual. And then when I inquired more about it, like when I threw in some of the, you know, ambiguity of what people have said about the ambiguity in those areas, he said something like, well, now I'm not clear. Like, is it mental imagery, or am I thinking about mental imagery? Right. It's like that's just an example of how difficult it can be, especially for the people that aren't on the extreme end of saying, like, there's some people that are very confident, like, I see things extremely visually, but there's this large swath of people, it seems to me, that like, how do I exactly describe those things? Yeah. So go on. Yeah.
So that's a good interjection. I'm on your side as far as that goes, because people don't use the same terminology about their own inner experience as they use about the external world. And they don't know that, that people are very ignorant about how they use their own words. And I would say people are pretty ignorant, many people, maybe most people, but many people are quite ignorant about their own inner experience. And so there are a lot of people who are sort of like you, who said, if I'm recalling correctly, you said something, well, I don't have very much of this imagery stuff. And some people, when they say that, are right. And other people, when they say that, are wrong. And it can go either way. There are a lot of people out there. I have sampled with a lot of people who say, I never have visual imagery. And yet at some random beeps, they've got quite a bit of visual imagery. Mm-hmm. And vice versa. Other people who say, I've got visual imagery all the time. But when we get it to the beeps, it turns out that they don't have it. And part of it is the reason that you identified, is that they think of themselves as visual until you really start to ask, well, what do you mean by visual? And then when you pin them down on that, well, it turns out visual doesn't have anything to do with something that you would see, And that's worse, I would say, it's worse with the inner speech deal, because inner speech is sort of has a wider uncertainty of definition that maybe even in visual imagery, but all of them are terrible. People are very unspecific about what they mean.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Go ahead.
The clearest example from that I would give is about the word thinking. Where you ask people what thinking means, and they will tell you, well, thinking is some kind of a cognitive thing where I'm trying to decide this kind of a thing. And then you beep them and they say, I was thinking about something. And when it turns out that what thinking means then, when they're describing their own inner experience, for one person would mean, I'm seeing a visual image. And for another person, thinking is going to be, I'm talking to myself in inner speech. And for another person, the word thinking, as in I'm thinking, means I have a emotional experience. And mm-hmm. for another person, the word thinking means I feel a tingle in my back or something like that. Mm-hmm. The point that I'm trying to make here is that the word thinking, when applied in the external world, has a Webster kind of definition. Mm-hmm. But the word thinking, when applied to me, has a private personal definition, which probably I acquired at age 2 or 3 or something like that, when I heard my mother or whoever say thinking, and what that meant was something going on in her that I can't see. So I apply that to me. What's going on with me? What I can't see. Mm-hmm. And so when I apply that word to myself, it means whatever is sort of frequent for me, I call that thinking. Mm-hmm. So that's the reason why I, or one of the reasons, one of many reasons why I'm skeptical about questionnaires, because questionnaires ask questions that use sort of public definitions, and public definitions and private definitions are not the same. Mm-hmm. And I'm skeptical of armchair introspection, because we like you gave in your example, where you were giving a easy interview, a slight interview with a guy who changed his mind about what was visual. Mm-hmm. You've got to, if you really want to know what's going on in somebody else's experience, you have to be careful in that interviewing method.
Yeah, I really liked your, I was reading some of your work and describing, like, the, I think you call it the unsymbolized thinking. I think that was what it was called, where it's like, sometimes you, if you inquire, you know, like you do inquiring at the moment, sometimes if you really inquire what you're currently thinking, it's just like, you know, is a rough non-cognitive thing of like, is this thing going to happen? But it's not like verbal or anything. It's like, just kind of like imagining if something's going to happen, or it doesn't require any verbal, or even, yeah, there's, but sometimes we'll put those into words. Like, if, you know, we'll put a narrative to it, you know, it's like, so we'll apply the, yeah, it's just really hard to pin down exactly what's going on there. But I want to, I did want to ask, going back to the aphantasia thing, it's like, you see these kind of confident descriptions sometimes about that, like people, like journalists, for example, or writers will write about like, oh, 3% of people have aphantasia or these kinds of things. Whereas, like, to me, in just talking to people, I found that seems really like a strange, overly confident or just wrong way to describe it, because when I've delved into this with random people, including doing Twitter surveys of, people who follow me, it's like there seems a lot more range of ambiguity and even like trying to describe, trying to pinpoint whose interviewing is highly visual versus not seems really hard to do. But I'm curious if you have a personal take from everything you've researched and read, like how do you group the general population into, or do you into like highly visual versus non-visual if you do?
So I think since Galton, since Sir Francis Galton, who was the sort of the first guy to explore widely the visual nature, and he discovered that members of the Academy that had reported, and he believed them, and I think there's reason to believe them, widely different frequencies of visual imagery. So I think it's true. I think it is true that people have widely different frequencies of visual imagery. That's number one. Number two is I don't think people are very good reporters about that. As I said a little bit ago, people I think are substantially mistaken about that. So anybody who tells you they know what the percentage of people is, you could ask them, are you doing a method that's at least as good as Hurlburt's? And if they say no, then you should say, well, then there's no reason why I should believe you. And I'm not saying my method is the best method. I'm saying you got to do something that's better than just asking somebody, because
Something
asking somebody,
methodological, yeah, something with some method to it, yeah.
right? And it can't be a questionnaire, and it can't be just a sort of a casual interview. You have to have worked out some kind of a method. So what is aphantasia? I think it's a more a popular term than it is a, it's sort of like atenesia or something like that. Some people play tennis, some people don't play tennis. And there's a guy who doesn't play tennis. We'll give him a name. We'll call him an atenesia kind of a thing.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that because it's what I've gathered. I see so many people using these labels for themselves, or and it kind of strikes me. It seems like people in general are so label happy, with when it comes to these kinds of ambiguous mental, whether it's, it could be autism or any number of things where it's like, yes, there are some differences, but we're also too quick to lump ourselves into these categories without really knowing where the boundaries are. And I see a lot of people, confidently saying like, oh, I have aphantasia, or I do or don't have an inner monologue. And I just think that seems to me to be like, it's almost like an interest of like, I want to quantify myself, or I want to confidently have some sort of label for these strange inner experience things to kind of make sense of it, a confusing inner thing, because I do think there is something, I think there's something kind of like almost like it's interesting, but also almost stressful in a way to have these large differences with other people, these fundamental differences, or at least perceived differences. So it's almost like we want to be like, oh, I'm in this group, and other people are in this group. I don't know if you have noticed that too, of like almost like a label happiness for these kinds of experiences, or conditions.
So I think in broad strokes, I would agree with what you said. I haven't applied myself to trying to understand why that is. But that it is pretty self-evident, I think. People don't. It's, from my point of view, it's sort of an interesting thing, because I think inner experience is about the most interesting question that there is. And I think a lot of people agree with that. Maybe even most people agree with that. And I think it's remarkable how methodologically sloppy people are, including maybe especially psychology or philosophy or whatever. And people are not methodologically sophisticated in answering that question. You would think if you knew what the most interesting question is, that you would work at trying to answer it. But most people, it would appear, would prefer to give an answer than to have the right answer. And that's what people call them, aphantasia or whatever.
Yeah, I've It just in general, like surveys in general, often strike me just as so bad for whatever it is. It's like there's just so much ambiguous language that will mean different things to different people. And that's, I'm constantly examining surveys for, including political, psychological surveys for, that could mean many different things to many different people. And then you get into inner experience areas where it's even more ambiguous, it's so the difficulty is 10 times, hundreds of times harder or something.
I agree.
So when it comes to inner monologue, I mean, that's another area where just when I've tried to inquire about my own thinking, it's to try to, there just seems to be so much ambiguity in the sense that sometimes I am thinking in ways that could be called monologue-like. Sometimes there's repeating, like a sentence that repeats in my head or is much more verbal than at other times. And other times it's more like the unsymbolized kind of thinking that you describe where it, and sometimes it's hard to tell what it is, right? It's like did I when I'm thinking about what I just thought, sometimes it's like could it, and I think a way to see the ambiguity is sometimes what stood out to me was sometimes I will have a fully formed thought, but that I want to communicate, but it's quite hard for me to put that into words because I'll have to work for a while at like how do I phrase that, right? Or I'll be missing a word, right? But like the thought is there in my head, in some way. It's just clearly not verbal because the fact that you have to work at describing this amorphous thought that you have is hard to get out. And that's what stood out to me in terms of like, yeah, sometimes my inner thought is like I'm writing something, but other times it's just amorphous kind of concepts and I have to think about getting those out. But would you agree that seems to be the case for most people? And so trying to like lumps people lumping themselves into like, I have an inner monologue or I don't have inner monologues. That seems like I would imagine that's a faulty binary framing for what most people have a wide range of experiences, if that makes sense.
So that's a complicated set of questions in there, but let me see whether I can make sense out of them. So you described a rather wide range of experiential things. Sometimes I got a full sentence, sometimes I've got just sort of a hint of something, sometimes there's a sentence with some holes in it, and sometimes there's whatever. There were a lot of sometimes in there. The question, well, the one question would be, well, how much of that should you call inner monologue or inner speech or something? And the answer to that varies widely. So I think the people, many people who say, well, I got 100% inner speech, what they mean, if they were halfway careful about that, would mean all those things that you talked about, I'm going to call those inner speech. And if you're going to talk about that, then I got 100% about that. But they don't usually say that. They usually say, I just got 100% inner speech. But if you nail them down, so okay, let's be interested in inner speech. I'm happy to be interested in inner speech, but let's know what we're talking about. And so does speech have to involve words? Well, if you say yes, then inner speech has to involve words. Well, that narrows it down because there's quite a bit of what you described in the range of your stuff, which is sort of like leaning into something that doesn't have any words to it. And so then if it has to involve words, does it have to involve a voice? If we're going to call it inner speech, external speech has to involve some kind of an experience of a voice or of speaking or something. Well, and it gets to be hard because you can have word in the inner world, you can have words without a voice, and you can have a voice without words, and you can have a complete sentence, and you can have a partial sentence, and you can have a hint of a sentence, all those things. And how much of it do you call inner speech? Well, there's a lot of variability in there. But I personally think if you're going to call something speech, it has to have words involved. If it's at least has to have that. And if it doesn't have words in it, then you probably shouldn't call it speech. I
There's
think
also,
that would be true in the external world. If you heard a, you wouldn't say, oh, my desk was speaking to me. You would You would say, I heard a knock on my desk or something like that.
I had some sensations of some
sort. Yeah. When you're in speech, if you heard speech, and if somebody were singing la 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 whatever, you wouldn't say, Russ was speaking. No, you'd say he was singing or something. So there's got to be words involved, I think, if you're going to call it inner speech. But when you do that, and then you get sort of careful about discerning whether there are words present, then the frequency drops dramatically down from 100 down to 25 or something.
There's also this ambiguity around, like, people will say, like, I hear my inner voice in my voice, basically. And I've thought about that too, where it's like, I feel like, yeah, there's so much ambiguity around that, because sometimes if I inquire, like, oh, I had some sentence like or verbal like thoughts, is that in a specific voice? And then there's almost this element of like, well, yeah, I guess it's in my, you know, the sound of my voice, but in another way, it's very amorphous. And maybe I'm just fooling myself into thinking like, well, that's just kind of like the voice I know or think I know. So if I had to put a name to what the sound of that voice, it's my voice. And I think there's a lot of ways to fool yourself. But I've seen, you know, in that area, people saying like, yes, I hear this voice and it's in my voice. And I'm like, is it really in your voice? Or are you just, you know, sort of like you've described, it's like we can fool ourselves and see things that aren't there for those things. And, you know, assume it would be in our voice and these kind of things.
So people make all those kinds of assumptions and it gets in the way of their actually paying attention to what's actually going on in their inner experience. I call those presuppositions. People have presuppositions about the way things are. And people would prefer to corroborate their own presuppositions rather than to find out what the truth actually is. And that's the way most people are, actually. But it doesn't get you at what's the interesting question. So when I say the interesting question is, well, what's Zach's inner experience really like? Some people would say, well, you don't really want to know what Zach's experience is really like. You want to know what Zach's would tell you his experience is really like. And I would say, I don't really care much about what Zach would tell me about his inner experience. I would like to know about his real inner experience, because he's going to tell me what he tells me would be a mix of what his experience is, plus how he wants to present himself, plus what he wants to think about me, plus what he told somebody else, and he's trying to be consistent with that, and what any other self-presentation biases that he might have that get mixed up into that. And all of that stuff makes a mess, which by comparison to what is actually going on in Zach's experience at the moment of some beep, well, that would be interesting to me.
Yeah, it seems, I mean, I could say, I just think like a lot of human experience, there's so much chaos and uncertainty and like multiple threads going on. And then like, I mean, people have written about, yeah, boiling down this really complex and convoluted thing into this like single simple narrative. And I just feel I can sense that in my own thinking. It's like there can be a tendency to try to put it in some sort of order, but often it just seems like it's all over the place and it's hard. It's really hard to pin down. And there's an element of like, you know, like those experiments they did on people with split brains, where they would make up explanations for the things that they did without, you know, even though they would be doing something or seeing something, but wouldn't know why and would confabulate. And it kind of reminds me too of like, you know, the blind spot in your eye where the optic nerve goes in and your vision just kind of smooths it over. It's like, there's so much of this hiding of all the chaos that goes on under the surface, I feel like, when it comes to, you know, our inner reports of what our experience is like. And yeah, sometimes I can just really feel the chaos of like, I don't really know. There's all sorts of weird, random, you know, dead ends and multiple layers going on at the same time sometimes that. Yeah.
So what I would say about that is I think there is chaos. I would prefer to call it multi-processing, but chaos is as good a word as either one of those is fine with me.
Chaotic multiple processing.
Yeah. The question is whether what you said is a sort of a general characteristic of Zach, or whether it is a at some particular moment characteristic of Zach. And so it could be that at some particular moment, Zach is experiencing this chaos, that's all these things going on. Or it could be that at some particular moment, Zach has determined, his body has determined, his bag of bones, whatever that is, has determined, bones and neurons and synapses and whatever, has determined that for this particular moment, he's interested in the gold picture, the goldness of the picture that's in the back of my head, and of all the chaos that he could be interested in, he has zeroed in on that, and at that particular moment there's no chaos, I'm zeroed in on that gold. Mm-hmm. But it's very difficult for Zach or anybody else to recall that at a particular moment he was interested in gold, because he was actually the sort of the overall thing, he was trying to figure out what question to ask next, or what he thought about Hurlbert or whatever that was, and the gold, which actually drew him at that particular moment, would be forgotten like a dream on waking, you know. A second later that'd be gone,
right?
But that is, I think, what makes up Zach's actual inner life. Maybe he clearly makes this the figure of his perception, whatever you want to call that, the figure of his consciousness, whatever is before the footlights of his consciousness. There aren't any good terms for that, but something becomes centralized, focused, thematized, whatever you want to say about that, for Zach at a particular moment, and then something else at another particular moment, and then something else at a particular moment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's those are the kinds of things that I'm interested in.
Okay. Yeah, it made me think of the kind of trance-like state when you're focused on something, like you're driving and your mind's kind of like blank, seemingly blank, but who knows what it was really doing. It's hard to say what it was doing. It was kind of dreamlike or trance-like or something. And maybe that's a good, I was going to ask you this thing I've wondered about dreams, which I think seems kind of related, and I don't know how many opinions you have on dreams, but one thing I've thought about dreams is that I don't think, at least for me, I don't think they're visual. I think they basically are concepts and ideas that kind of go straight into memory, and they get stored in a similar way because they're in our memory, and so they can have elements of they can be hard to distinguish from the memories of visual things we've seen. But I think for me, when I remember dreams, it's often like, it's not like there's a set image. It's more like, I know things happen. They're like, it's much more conceptual and idea related. And that to me seems related to the mental imaging thing, because I feel like it kind of helps explain why those things can be, it helps explain why they're so ephemeral too in our memory, because they aren't like, they don't have all the solidity of like, I actually saw something and had all these extra details. It's just like the bare wisps of like, ideation and concepts coming together. And I don't know how you feel about that, like whether dreams or everyone's dreams are actually visual, if you have any thoughts on that.
So I would say, first, I'm not a dream researcher, so I don't feel I'm not in a position to say I'm an expert on that subject. Second, I would bet against almost everything that you said in your last question. If I were a betting man, I would say most of what I would guess that most of what you said is not true. I think most people have dream. Most people who dream probably do dream, or many people. Let's not say most, but let's say many people, and by many I mean a lot, dream, and it's entirely visual. Or a big part of it is visual. I would bet most of the ranch at pretty good odds on that statement being true. And it's the same thing as I would say there are many people who in their everyday waking life, which I think I do know something about, have visual imagery. And it makes every bit of sense to say I saw whatever that was, but it wasn't really there. It was in my imagination. So I would say I'm innerly saw that. And there are some people who innerly see and convinced me, and I'm as skeptical as they come, or probably more skeptical than almost anybody, you know, or a lot of people. I'm a very skeptical guy. So I want to, when somebody says I'm seeing something, I want to know what they're talking about. And I'm convinced that many people, when they say I am seeing, when they say I'm having an image, they mean I'm innerly seeing something. Other people who will say I'm having an image, they mean something conceptual, like you were describing. Hmm. But that is, I would say most people who talk about having an image are having some kind of visual experience. But I mean, I don't want to get us down into counting the number of people who are doing that kind of thing. But I, from the standpoint of what the phenomenon is, I would say I am 99.9999% sure that some people innerly see things with every bit as clarity and maybe more clarity than external seeing. And it's just as visual an experience as an external seeing would be. In the sense that there's colors and there's forms and there's motion sometimes, and sometimes it's clear and sometimes it's not. And
have there been studies on like brain imaging to see if when people are doing that, do things show up in like visual areas? Has there been that kind of stuff? Do you know?
There has been that kind of stuff, and most of that kind of stuff would corroborate that there is visual. The visual cortex lights up when people are reporting having visual. Mm. It's those studies are not as good as I would like them to be, mm-hmm. but then very few studies are as good as I would like them to be. But because they're mostly about self-reported, people at this time are saying I'm having a visual image, and I think there's reason to be skeptical about that until you've got somebody pretty well trained and knows what we're talking about when we mean that. And those studies don't generally have anywhere near adequate training. I've done one set of studies, one small study or set of studies or whatever, where I've put people into the scanner and using the descriptive sampling method I'm talking about, and just let them do whatever it is that they're trying to do, or would be happy to do in the scanner. And sometimes there's visual imagery, and sometimes there's inner speaking and whatever. Mm-hmm. I think we've had enough. Scanner studies require a lot of reps, and it's hard to do this. And we're putting people in the scanner for like 10 hours. So it's a little tough to do that at scale. But I think we've done enough. We've done enough where I'm pretty convinced that there's reason to believe that when I tell you that I've got a subject and that person's got visual imagery and it really is seeing, you should believe me. That's what I think. Mm-hmm. And you can say, well, you know, Russ could be crazy, which he might be, but I think I have a track record that you shouldn't just dismiss. Let's put it that way.
Have they done a study? I mean, have they noticed when it comes to that lighting up the visual cortex in inner thought things, have they noticed big differences in people that in the aphantasia, kind of like these people report it, seeing mental imagery and their brains light up in that way, and these people don't report it? Has there been anything like that? Or
so I'm not particularly an expert in that, but I would be pretty confident answering that question. Yes.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. I know there hasn't been actual, from what I was reading, there hasn't been, you know, that much research on the whole aphantasia thing. So it sounds like maybe nobody's really done that.
And that could be too. I don't claim to be an expert there.
Gotcha.
The reason that I'm not particularly interested in that literature is that
they may be bad describers is what you're saying. Yeah. Even if they say it, they may not be accurate describers of what's going on inside. Yeah.
Right.
Right. Gotcha. Yeah. That makes sense. So, yeah. These things are just, I mean, even just the most basic psychological things are so hard to study. So it's like this just seems much harder to study. Well, yeah.
I've thought about saying this for a while, so I'll say it now. So let me tell you why armchair introspection is difficult. And by armchair introspection, I mean, well, I'm going to ask myself what's going on in my inner experience. And one of the reasons that that's difficult is that if you ask yourself, well, what's going on in my inner experience right now? Well, what's going on in your inner experience right now is you're asking yourself the question, what's going on in my inner experience right now? But you think that's not important. I want to rule that out because obviously I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in my experience that goes beyond that. But the problem is you're ruling out everything that's there. What's there is, and when you're in the armchair introspection mode, is the question, the intention of asking yourself, what's going on in my inner experience? That's what's in my inner experience. And then you rule it out and you can't find anything else that's left. And then you say all kinds of crap after that because you have ruled out what's actually there.
Right.
And so what you need, I think, is some kind of an external signal to get you to engage in that armchair introspection task without the armchair, which is what the beeper is about. Mm-hmm. Some people derisively say, well, you know, Hilbert says he's got a magic beeper or whatever. Well, that's not true. What I say is, I have an external signal that has a well-defined characteristic. It's a beep, and the beep is either not here or it's there. It's got it has a sudden rise time, and it comes at a time that's not under your control. So you don't have to ask yourself. And that's a big deal when it comes to introspection. And people will say, critics will say, well, you know, you hear the beep and then you got to decide to introspect. Well, yes, that's true. But this is a skill that you can amass over a while so that you can do that skill pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, well, can you do it quickly enough? And so William James says, you know, introspection is like turning up the gas to see what the darkness looks like or something like that. Mm-hmm. Well, that's hard to do, but it was harder for James than it is for us because James had to turn up the gas, where we have the virtue or the advantage of being able to create a beep in a way that was out of his ability. So I can't give you a beep and ask you to and turn up the light to see what the darkness looks like, but I can, I think, give you a beep that allows you to see what kind of nocturnal animals are there before they get a chance to scurry away into the holes or wherever. And so I'm not getting a complete picture of what the darkness looks like, but I'm getting a picture of the darkness that's better than armchair introspection work. Because armchair introspection is, you know, I got to decide to do this and think about that. And,
Yeah, you're trying to sneak up on it and catch it in the act. Yeah. So getting back to the dream question, because I personally am just very interested in dreams. But when you said that you were confident that dreams were visual, there's also that the point that I think was brought up in that book you had with Schwitzkable, where the point that people reported in the 1950s dreaming in black and white, and then they reported dreaming in color. And that's not to say I'm not confident at all. Like, I don't have any confident beliefs that dreams are visual or originate in visual or don't originate in visual. But I'm curious, like, you seem pretty confident in the visual like origin of them. I was just kind of curious what was behind that confidence.
Why should I be confident about that? Mm-hmm.
If you are confident, yeah.
So setting aside that I'm not going to talk about dreams because I don't know much about dreams, but I talk about experience in general, and I think people can be confident about talking about visual experience in general. And if they can talk about it in general, they should be able to talk about it in their dreams as well, it seems to me, which is where. And so why would I be confident about it in their waking life? Well, the example that you gave, I had a participant, couple actually, who of older folks, they were 75 or 80-ish people. And the one woman that I have in mind right now said, I have quite a lot of visual imagery, and she did. And so a beep occurred when she had visual imagery. And so she told me at one beep, I was seeing my flower garden. I wasn't in my flower garden, but I was imagining my flower garden, and I could see the yellows of the daffodils and the red of the roses and all laid out just like they were in my experience. And then in another picture, she said, I see my piano, and on my piano is a photograph of my son in the army, and he's in his uniform in front of the flag. And I see this whole scene in color. detail, and I can, you know, the picture is looking in this direction, and it's like it really is in the real world. And so she's given me a description that makes sense. And then on the third day, she says, you know, I don't think I've been honest with you. I've been trying to be honest with you, but I don't think I have, because what I am now seeing in my experience is that my visual imagery is in black and white when it occurs. And then when I tell you about it, I colorize it, and I don't feel myself colorizing. But when I, you know, so for example, when I, if I were to really be careful, to have been careful on that second day when I told you I saw my son in front of the flag, I think, she says, that at the moment of the beep, that vision was in black and white, and there was no red, white, and blue on the flag. There was black and gray and white on the flag. But then when you asked me about it, and I reflected back on it and couldn't put all my attention to that, well, then I produced it in color. And so what I think happens in that kind of thing is that a person, when they get older, loses some of their computational power, whatever that is. I don't have a theory about computational power, but you're going to simplify your life. And one important way to simplify your life is to deal with black and white imagery rather than color imagery. So if you look at, if you're a computer person, you know that a black and white image has a lot fewer pixels to it, a lot fewer bits to it, same number of pixels, a lot fewer bits to it than a color image, because you got to provide the color information as well as all the rest of the information. And so the processing that on a computer can process black and white imagery a whole lot faster than it can process color imagery. So what I think happens for people, older people, who when they go through life, they're seeing this image in their mind and seeing that and seeing whatever, and they're extracting out of that the information that they need, and it's not probably the color information. But when they stop and think about it, or stop and focus on some particular aspect, well, then the color information becomes somewhat more salient again, and they put it in there. So that kind of experience with me makes it seem to me, well, here's a woman who had, that's a pretty high powered theory that she's spinning. There's no reason why she would have had that in mind. She didn't have the theory. What I told you was the theory. She told me I was lying to you. You know, I was trying to be honest to you, but I think I was lying to you. Why would she say that if she didn't really have visual experience that was in some ways black and white and in some other ways in color?
Yeah, I guess the skeptic would say, if she's thinking of those, if she has an, you know, the concept of that image of her son's picture or whatever it is, it's like that's sparking all the neurons associated with that. So then later she's kind of like, from all those, the construction of all the things that spark all those things, she's saying, she's adding detail, like the faultiness of memory and such. But
I totally agree with that, and that's why the method that I say, the descriptive experience sampling method, has to be iterative. I don't think we've used that word here, but iterative means we got to do this over and over again, because there's no way to answer the question that you just asked about an instance which has already occurred. Mm-hmm. But there is a way to say, well, and I could say to this woman that we're talking about here, well, isn't that interesting? Maybe going forwards, when the beep happens and you've got really the only shot that you've got is right then. When the beep happens and you got a visual imagery, well, pay attention to whether it's in black and white or color. That's sort of interesting. So you're never going to get a better shot at that, including asking a philosopher about that, because the skeptics aren't going forwards. They're going backwards. They're given an explanation like you just gave, which is fine, perfectly good explanation, but it's not an adequate explanation, because the only time the explanation actually counts is at the next beep. And the one after that.
A quick note here. Obviously, I can only speak about my own experiences here, but I will say that even though I think it'd be easy for me to think of my dreams as visual in nature, I think that perception mainly comes from the tendency to assume that things we find in our memory have their origins in visual experiences. But I tend to question that assumption. For example, I seldom have a sense of having seen a dream scene from a specific angle. It's often more just concepts and ideas that make up a scene. Even when I sometimes have a sense of something being visual, it's hard for me to say confidently that it was really a visual experience and not, to quote the acquaintance that I spoke with, more like thinking about visualizations. This all reminds me of a strong ketamine trip I had once where I was conscious of having all sorts of conceptual scenes running through my mind. For example, the sense that I was experiencing all sorts of battles and conflicts in the early days of human history, but nothing I experienced was actually visual. But as Russ would probably agree, it's difficult enough to study waking conscious life. It's much more difficult to study dreams, which we only consciously remember after they're over. And of course, it's possible that because I don't have mental imagery or don't see myself as having mental imagery, maybe my dreams are much less visual than other people's are. Okay, back to the talk.
If I was going to read the book that you wrote with Schwitzkobol, is that still a good explanation of your ideas in that book? I know it was put out a while ago. Do you still recommend it as like a way to understand your views?
I haven't read that book. That book is 15 years old now. I think the answer to that is, in general, yes. There are probably some details that I would squirm at what I said then, what I would probably say now, different now. But I think in broad strokes, the answer to that would be yes.
Cool. I wanted to read that. I plan on reading that. Is there anything you wanted to throw in that you think we didn't touch on that you'd like to mention that you think people would find interesting in this area before we end?
I would say anybody who's interested ought to go to my website and poke around and watch it happen. Watch descriptive experience sampling happen.
And what's the website?
I don't know. I'll have to send it to you.
Oh,
if you Googled me, let me see what I
can. Is it live currently?
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you Google me, you would find my website. And my website is called hurlburt.faculty.unlv.edu.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Yeah, and I'll put a link to it on the.
And on the left hand side of that website is a link that's called Complete DES Interviews with Annotated Transcripts. And if you clicked on that link, that would take you to 100 hours worth of interviews with aphantasia people and face blind people and journalists.
And it's hurlburt.faculty.unlv.edu. Was that
yes.
it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Gotcha. I'll email it to you and make sure you got it right. But
yeah. But for people listening, I just want to make sure they checked it out. Okay. Thanks a lot, Russ. This was great. And I think people will find this very interesting.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
That was a talk with Russell Hurlburt, the author of several books on inner experience. You can get some links to resources that we mentioned in this talk at the entry for this talk on my site, peoplewhoreadpeople.com. Thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.